On this edition of Jazz Profiles, we'll celebrate the extraordinary life and career of record producer and concert promoter Norman Granz. He died in 2001, a year after this show was produced.
Good evening, I'm Norman Granz.
If anyone doesn't know what Norman Granz has done for jazz now, then they shouldn't be listening to jazz.
Hi, here we go. We're rolling. 20452, just one of those things. Take 7.
It was just one of those things.
Excuse me. I don't like that beginning. I wanted to just start out cold. I don't like that intro. It just occurred to me. I just heard it for the first time. All right, here we go.
Hey, Norm, suppose we make the same thing. And she goes into it.
That's what you just did.
No, we were doing something else.
Oh, you were? I don't know. I...
Oh, what a clam bake this thing turned.
Rolling. 20452, take 8.
No matter who the recording featured, Norman Granz always ran the show, as he demonstrated on that 1957 session with trumpeter Harry Edison and singer Billie Holiday. As a record producer and concert promoter, Norman Granz has no equal in the history of jazz, or indeed popular music. The quantity and quality of his endeavors is reflected by the myriad of musicians and singers whose careers he enhanced. From the mid-40s through the mid-80s, Norman Granz at one time or another recorded or presented such diverse figures as Louis Armstrong, John Coltrane, Ella Fitzgerald, Miles Davis, Bud Powell, and Fred Astaire. I'm Nancy Wilson, and on this edition of Jazz Profiles, we explore the life and career of the remarkable Norman Granz.
Lester Young. Dizzy Gillespie.
Norman hasn't got the slightest interest in his reputation. He doesn't care about people's opinions, only the musicians.
British author and critic Benny Green.
He looks upon himself as a kind of conduit down which the music has flowed, and that's all. In that sense, he has no ego at all.
This is drummer Buddy Rich, who wasn't known for bestowing compliments lightly.
Granz simply had good taste when it came to rhythm sections. And I don't mean that for the drums. I mean, think about Oscar Peterson, think about Ray Brown, think about Herb Ellis, think about Barney Kessel. When I say, I wasn't being facetious, I'm saying that he had the kind of an ear that knew what rhythm section would fit what group.
Buddy Rich, along with bassist Ray Brown, guitarist Herb Ellis, and pianist Oscar Peterson, performing in 1955 at a Jazz at the Philharmonic concert in Chicago. JATP, as it had become universally known, was created by Norman Granz. His idea was to bring together the finest jazz musicians of the day and present them in what was essentially a jam session format. From a 1957 television show, Norman Granz remembers his first concert presentation.
1944 was my privilege to found jazz at the Philharmonic. No one would have guessed at that time, least of all myself, the extent to which these concerts would grow. It's been a fabulous experience. It's been my life. At that first concert of jazz greats, our piano soloist was Nat King Cole.
Thank you very much, Norman. You know, I'd like to let our listeners know before we begin that this is the first television appearance of Jazz at the Philharmonic. and that just last Wednesday you completed your 18th annual tour of presenting concerts all over the world, great cities all over the world. That's right, huh?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And now, since you and I like a lot of music and just a little talk in our appearances, how about your first number? And now, here's Nat with the Oscar Peterson Trio to do the jazz classic, Sweet Lorraine. Along with Oscar's piano, you hear Ray Brown on bass, Herb Ellis on guitar, and Coleman Hawkins will join them on the second chorus.
I just found joy. I'm as happy as a baby boy. With another brand new choo-choo toy. When I met my sweet Lorraine, Lorraine, Lorraine. She's got a pair of eyes that are brighter than the summer skies. When you see them, you'll realize why I love my sweet Lorraine.
The musicians involved with Jazz at the Philharmonic liked the concept, as did audiences around the world. JATP struck the right chord at the right time, as did the record label Verve and its subsidiaries Clef, Down Home, and Norgran, all formed by Norman Granz. Here's jazz disc jockey Les Davis, who's been an interested Granz watcher for many years.
Verve turned out to be a big umbrella for the other labels. And actually, Norman was recording more and more. You won't believe it, but in 1957, Downbeat magazine reviewed over 50 Verve albums during that year. And considering that Norman Granz does everything in a recording studio, and I mean everything, including cleaning up, that's an amazing record.
Jerry Mulligan on baritone and Paul Desmond alto saxophone playing Mulligan's composition Line for Lions. It comes from one of those 50-plus albums Norman Granz produced for his Verve label during 1957. Norman Granz was born on the 6th of August, 1918, in Los Angeles, California. His parents had immigrated to the United States from Russia. Times were hard, and Norman had to pay his way through college by working in a brokerage house. He discovered jazz early, and by 1940 had become friends with, among others, Nat Cole, Lester Young, and Billie Holiday. It was around that time that he was hired by MGM as a film editor, and he hoped to move on to become a director. But his love for jazz took over, and he began to organize jam sessions in Los Angeles nightclubs. Along with presenting good music, Granz had another objective in mind, Les Davis.
Norman wanted a situation where black people could come in and sit down alongside the white public. Now, he had proved that at Billy Berg's club. He'd proved that if the club owners were prepared to suspend the segregation policy, many, many more people would come to the club.
As he neared his 26th birthday in 1944, Norman Granz created a landmark event. He presented the first Jazz at the Philharmonic concert. Again, Les Davis.
The first Jazz at the Philharmonic concert was held at the Carnegie Hall of L.A., Philharmonic Auditorium, on July 2, 1944. And once again, his love for the music and his desire for social justice come together. There was an organization known as the Sleepy Lagoon Committee, which had been formed to raise money for the defense of 30 to 40 young Mexican kids who'd been arrested for the murder of a member of a rival gang. And Granz felt, as he always has, sociologically motivated. And if he could help to further the jazz cause at the same time, then he would be particularly satisfied.
With the enormous success of that first Jazz at the Philharmonic concert in 1944, Norman Granz continued to present the shows once a month for the remainder of that year. In 1945, he decided to test the concept further by putting together a tour. It started in San Diego, moving on to Los Angeles and San Francisco. Then came Portland and Seattle. The next stop was Victoria, British Columbia. It turned out to be the last stop.
Norman was running around like crazy, operating as his own advance man, and he goes to each city and tries to drum up ticket sales and any publicity he can manufacture from local radio stations and newspapers. Now, the agent who had booked the tour, upon being told that things looked horrible in Victoria, told Norman that there were some good dates to be had in Texas with good money. But Granz said no, he would not play the South. I don't want to go anywhere where there's that kind of blatant segregation. So the tour ended in Victoria, and Norman Granz had to hock everything he owned in order to get the musicians back to New York or wherever their homes were.
Helping the musicians really established Granz's reputation. Word quickly spread that he could be counted on and that he was a good person to work with. Despite the financial setback, Norman Granz managed to regroup, and JATP quickly resumed its activities. He also decided to begin recording and releasing some of the concerts. Norman remembers.
The first concert I recorded was the one which subsequently appeared as Volume 4, the one with Nat Cole and Les Paul and Illinois Jacket. That was the first one that I had actually thought of putting out. But I think it was 6 months later in another concert, I did the How High the Moon album, and that was with Krupa and Ventura and McGee and Joe Guy and people like that. And I don't know why, I just thought that that was a better one to come out with first. And I had a particular affinity for the song. I happen to have liked the How High the Moon, so I just decided to put that out first.
High the Moon, featuring trumpeter Joe Guy and Howard McGee, tenor saxophonist Charlie Ventura, and drummer Gene Krupa. It comes from a February 1945 JATP concert, the first one to be issued on record. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Norman Granz. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1946, Norman Granz formed his first record label, Clef. 3 years later, he came up with another innovation, at least in the jazz world. He released a boxed set made up of six 12-inch 78s under the title of The Jazz Scene. The set sold for $25, a large sum 50-plus years ago. Pianist Bud Powell and saxophonist Charlie Parker, Lester Young, and Coleman Hawkins were among those who recorded performances for The Jazz Scene boxed set.
I was just beginning and I had very little money, but I always wanted to do something that would reflect what was going on in music at that time. I was hampered, obviously, by a lot of contracts of other companies, so I really couldn't use the people I wanted. No, each side was clearly designed for what it was. Coleman Hawkins, for example, took the playing of the solo side so seriously that we originally did it with Roundabout Midnight. And he didn't like what he did. I remember spending hours with Hawk, and finally we both agreed that he just wasn't comfortable with it, and he came back about 3-4 months later and did an ad-lib thing, which we called Picasso.
Picasso, the solo performance by Coleman Hawkins from The Jazz Scene boxed set. There was also supposed to have been a duet track featuring Charlie Parker and Art Tatum, but as Norman Granz recalls, there were problems.
The only piece that didn't come off, which we substituted for, I had finally gotten Art Tatum to do a side with Charlie Parker. And I remember renting Carnegie Hall. I wanted to get that vast sound with just these two people. And Bird was there, but Tatum didn't show up. And I was stuck with a Hall. So I just asked Charlie to stand by. And in those days in New York, you could get on the phone and get fantastic musicians in short notice. So I got Hank Jones and Ray Brown, and I forgot the drummer on the date, to come up as quickly as they could, rather than let Charlie go. And we did the side called The Bird that went into the album.
Charlie Parker with pianist Hank Jones, bassist Ray Brown, and drummer Shelly Mann playing The Bird from The Jazz Scene set issued on Clef Records. Les Davis.
Well, after Clef, Norman Granz formed two other labels. One I'm sure you don't remember, Down Home Records. And Down Home featured New Orleans stars like George Lewis and Turk Murphy, Kid Ory. And then there was Norgran Records, which allowed Norman Granz to put some of the more modern artists in a separate context, leaving Clef as a home for the more mainstream approach, typified by artists like Lester Young, Roy Eldridge, Benny Carter, Johnny Hodges, Flip Phillips, Ben Webster, and singers including Billie Holiday.
Most of those artists were also involved with Jazz at the Philharmonic at one time or another. Given this unique coming together of major soloists, there could have been clashes of temperament. But as drummer Buddy Rich notes, this was never the case.
I did, I don't know, six or seven years. And I don't think there was ever a time on the tour, on any tour, no matter where we traveled to, where there was that kind of a feeling of animosity, there was the jealousy, ego. It never became involved in music because everybody had a chance to produce. If you didn't produce, it was your problem. But certainly, everybody was a big enough star and had a big enough attitude about themselves to not have to say something to anybody who was not up to it. were certain nights when nobody felt like playing. A long plane ride, for instance. Or being very cold, not having a chance to warm up before the gig. But I would say 99 9/10 of the time of every performance was 100%.
Buddy Rich. Norman Granz kept his musicians content on the road and in the recording studio as well. As a record producer, he offered the musicians the freedom to expand and explore.
I think I may have been the first one to use strings with an Ellington unit in the jazz scene. I couldn't use Duke's name, of course, because Duke was under contract to a company. So we made Harry Carney the leader, and we did, I think it's called Frustration, and something else that Duke actually came down and it may have been Billy Strayhorn who played, but Duke was there all the time, and I think he may even have played a bit, and he wrote the arrangements, and we used strings on that. Chamber music, really.
From the Jazz Scene boxed set, Frustration, featuring baritone saxophonist Harry Carney, with Duke Ellington as composer and arranger, recorded in 1947. Despite doubts about using strings in a jazz context, Norman Granz was wise enough to go along with the idea, as he did with Charlie Parker in 1949.
Charlie bugged me to do albums in strings, and I personally don't like strings because I don't think you can swing strings. But funnily enough, every musician wants strings. You have no idea. Every jazz artist I know that I've ever recorded has inevitably come to me, when are you going to give me strings? Ben Webster, when can I have strings? They all want strings, you see. They all think that it enhances the ballad and the rest. But for better or for worse, getting back to Charlie, he bugged me so much that he wanted strings that I gave it to him. It's just that easy.
Charlie Parker with strings, playing April in Paris, recorded in November 1949 and issued on Clef Records. That album, Bird with Strings, was to become one of Parker's most popular recordings. By the early 1950s, Norman Granz had become one of the chief jazz presenters and promoters in the world. Barely 30 years old, he had already worked with most of the great musicians of the day. In just a few years, he would go on to closely collaborate with a select few and create some of the most classic jazz albums to date, as you'll soon hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Norman Granz from NPR National Public Radio.
¶¶
Norman Granz is a great catalyst.
Pianist Oscar Peterson.
He's a man that has the ability to put together things that cause a fusion and cause sparks, and it causes reaction.
One of the most successful fusions was that between Norman Granz and singer Ella Fitzgerald. Ella had been a regular member of Jazz at the Philharmonic since 1948, but her contract with Decca Records prevented Norman Granz from recording her. Finally, late in 1955, he was able to obtain her release from Decca, and one of the first projects they worked on together was the Cole Porter Songbook for the Verve recording label that Norman formed in 1956. Granz gives us a glimpse of his approach as a producer for the songbook sessions.
I would begin researching Porter, and maybe I would come up with 50 songs, shall we say, that I thought would suit Ella. All right. I sit with Ella, and we discuss things in terms of the tunes that she feels a sympathy for, and we finally, shall we say, narrow it down, maybe do 20 songs or whatever. Now, at this point, I make an arbitrary choice, which isn't a musical choice, because the reason for a songbook was not only to display Ella, but partly to investigate what the songwriter was doing. So I might inject, as I did, maybe a very, very minor or long-forgotten tune, like, say, in the Gershwin's My Cousin from Milwaukee, shall we say. Well, the reason is obvious. I feel that it fleshes out what the songwriter was doing, and the reason was primarily Ella as an interpreter, but also, not unimportantly, what the writer was doing.
I got a cousin in Milwaukee. She's got a voice so squawky. And though she's tall and kind of gawky, oh, how she gets the men. Her singing isn't operatic. It's got a lot of static, but makes your heart get acrobatic. 9 times out of 10, when she sings hot, you can't be solemn. It sends the shivers up and down your spinal column. When she sings blue, the men shout, what stuff? That baby is hot stuff. So if you like the way I sing songs, if you think that I'm a wow, you can thank my squawky cousin from Milwaukee, because she taught me how.
The First Lady of Song, Miss Ella Fitzgerald, singing George and Ira Gershwin's My Cousin from Milwaukee, from Ella Sings the Gershwin Songbook, recorded in 1959 and issued on Verve Records. Norman chose Nelson Riddle as the arranger for the date.
I would sit with Nelson. I'd say, you know, why don't we, instead of having a conventional band, why don't we take some sides and do a quartet? And maybe some let's use strings and others let's not use strings. And Nelson agrees or disagrees. We discuss it. Ella's out of it totally. Ella is now finished, you see. And we even discussed the tempo possibilities, like the Lady Be Good thing. I said, why don't you write Lady Be Good as a ballad? Because Nelson thought maybe he'd do another scat thing with Ella. And in that way, you evolve into what is going to be done.
Well, if this isn't it, I don't have it.
All right, quiet, here we go. Lady Be Good, take 8.
Listen to my tale of woe. It's terribly sad but true. All dressed up, no place to go. Each evening I'm awfully blue. I must win some handsome guy. Can't go on like this. I could blossom out, I know, with somebody just like you. So, oh, sweet and lovely Lady Be Good,
finally, because I also like to inject jazz wherever possible, even though the songbooks were not jazz albums as such, I would say to Nelson, look, we're going to have 8 bars here. Why don't we give that to Ben Webster? Let's bring him in. So now we come to the session. At that juncture, there's very little I can do because all the work has been done. I certainly can't stop the session, say, change the arrangement. You can't stop the session, say, change the key, because it's written in Ella's key. So there's really very little you can do except placate your artist and maybe say, listen, I think I was wrong. Maybe Harry Edison shouldn't do that break. Let's give it to a saxophone player. If it's an ad-lib break. If it's written, you're dead. You have to do what's written.
When she sings hot, you can't be solemn. It sends the shivers up and down your spinal column. When she sings blue, the men shout, what stuff? That baby is hot stuff. So if you like the way I sing songs, if you think that I'm a wow, you can thank my squawky cousin from Milwaukee, because she taught me how.
Ella's series of songbooks remains unparalleled in the annals of 20th century popular music. Author and critic Benny Green.
Now, the songbooks, I would say, are the greatest single achievement in the recording field in popular music since the invention of the long player. What it did, apart from the fact established Ella as the singer of those standards of the century, it revived interest in and respect for Gershwin, Rodgers and Hart, Irving Berlin, all of them.
In 1957, Ella Fitzgerald recorded the Duke Ellington songbook. It turned out to be a rather difficult experience.
Duke and Strayhorn came to the studio with what should have been a totally prepared songbook and instead brought no arrangements at all. There's no written arrangements for Ella. And all Ella had to go with was Billy, primarily because Billy played piano on the project on most of the songs. And Ella suddenly found herself fitting to Duke's band. In fact, at one point in the project, she actually burst into tears. She was so frustrated, not knowing where she came in. And Duke and Billy both consoled her and straightened her out. And we managed to do the entire project, as I recall, in one day. Not that I might not have wanted more time, but that's all Duke had time for. I think he was probably traveling somewhere the next day.
From the recording session of June 27, 1957, here are Ella, Duke, and Billy Strayhorn working on Chelsea Bridge.
I would say when you get to the bridge, I mean, you have a general idea.
No, we're getting
it. She's all right in the middle. It's just, yeah, so I told her to let me play the thing, and then she answered me.
Why don't you make the entrance back into the
That's
thing.
What I'm doing.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I'm doing.
And
then she answers me.
She went da ba ba, and then you da ba 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 da ba da ba, and then she picked it up from there.
And then she answers me, though. She goes da ba da ba.
I sing a chorus, and then what else?
You sing a chorus, and then there's a half chorus.
Yeah, and then I come back into B.
Yeah.
Which engine are you talking about now?
This right here. Ba ba da ba. Let me make it both times, because see, the second time it'll be coming out of here.
Yeah.
Out of that. So just let me make it, and then you answer. And then come, then you, then right, the second go. Time we do it, then you come back in.
We try.
We're all straight now, you know. Everybody knows exactly what we're doing, don't we?
Thank you.
Chelsea Bridge in rehearsal for the Duke Ellington songbook release in 1957. Another Norman Grant's project for his Verve label featured the perfect pairing, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong.
My idea was to record two of them as much as I could, because I had all kinds of ideas for utilizing Louis with Ella. And so we did some good standards together, backed by Oscar, Ray Brown, and I think Herb Ellis or Barney Kessel, and Buddy Rich or Louis Belson.
You know, it never seemed like we were really recording, because he was always so happy, the same way he carried his handkerchief when he did a regular show.
Ella Fitzgerald.
He came in like it was nothing to it, just going to have a ball. And I would always mess up, because I'd be so fascinated watching him that sometimes I wouldn't come in on time on my song, you know, because he'd go through the whole motions just like he would really sing, you know, sing it, Ella, you know, and he'd be talking and cracking and making jokes and while he's talking. You don't know whether you should sing or laugh, but that's the kind of guy he was.
Yes, when you're at home alone, the blues will talk to you constantly. Yes. And when you're out in the crowd, the blues will haunt your memories. The nights when you don't sleep,
never. The whole night you're crying.
Yeah. But you can't forget her.
Soon you even stop trying.
Yes, man, you'll walk the floor. That's when it's rough. And wear out that last pair of treaders.
When you feel your heart break.
Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, Learning the Blues, backed by guitarist Herb Ellis, the bass of Ray Brown, drummer Louis Belson, and pianist Oscar Peterson. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to jazz impresario Norman Grants. I'm Nancy Wilson. Just as notable as his partnerships with Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong was the one he formed with Oscar Peterson. Norman was responsible for bringing the pianist from his native Canada to the United States in 1949. Again, Benny Green.
Norman and Oscar are, I would say, are friends and associates, almost conspirators in the way they create music first. And then the business relationship appears to me to be second. I don't think they ever signed any contracts or anything. There's no written agreement between them. They just like each other, respect each other. And they get on, and Norman has Oscar's interests at heart. It's the perfect relationship. I think it's the relationship that every artist of that caliber should have and never gets. They're both lucky men to have found each other.
Oscar Peterson won a Grammy in 1978 for his album recorded the previous year at the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. Produced by Norman Grants, it was issued on Pablo Records, the label Grants started in 1974. Here, Oscar Peterson recalls the discussions that took place with his friend and producer before the Montreux concert.
He came to me and said, you know, this is what I would like. Now, he doesn't insist, because he has one rule he's always operated by, and that is the final decision comes down to the artist, because they're the ones that are playing. So basically, I know it was left up to my discretion, but at least I knew what he wanted from us, and I agreed with what he was trying to accomplish. So much so that actually, and I say this not to be maudlin, not looking for any applause or a medal, I actually gave him the Grammy. It's his Grammy, it's not mine, really. Because, I have to be truthful and say that were it left up to me totally, I might have gone out and done a totally different, I might have, I'm not saying I would have, I might have. Now, it doesn't mean that the performance would be at a lower level. Let's just say that it might not have catapulted into what it catapulted into, because this is one of the sessions that I'm truly proud of all the jam session things I've done over the years.
This is Perdido from that Grammy Award-winning album. ¶¶ Oscar Peterson, with Niels Henning Orsted Patterson on bass, Bobby Durham on drums, featuring Eddie Lockjaw Davis on saxophone, and trumpeters Clark Terry and Dizzy Gillespie. Oscar Peterson has often noted that his greatest influence was Art Tatum. From late in 1953 until his death in 1956, Art Tatum recorded extensively for Norman Granz and his Clef label. All of those recordings would be reissued in the 70s on Pablo. Benny Green.
Granz's method was so simple that it smacks of genius. He got Tatum into the studio and let him play till he fell asleep. I mean, he played for days and recorded, I don't know, 200 and something songs, 20 albums of solo piano. Now, you've either got to be crazy or you've got to have the vision of a saint to be able to do that, to record one man 20 solo piano albums. Well, the result is that, you know, Tatum now will really never die because his output's there forever for posterity. They're among the greatest jazz recordings ever made.
Here, Art Tatum describes those solo recordings made for Clef Records.
We did all of those records in, say, about three nights' work. We cut about 100 sides the first night. Every master, you go straight down. I mean, there's no retakes. And then you can do that when you're playing piano solo by yourself, and you don't have to worry about anybody else. So you're playing completely by yourself, and with me, I can do that.
Of course, I think he was possibly the greatest instrumentalist of a particular instrument. And if one doesn't want to accept that, say, on the piano. What I meant was that here was a man that in his entire lifetime, up to the time that I recorded them, I don't think he had a half a dozen albums, you see? And I thought that that was shocking, that there would be nothing left when this man finally left the scene. And again, I wasn't recording for posterity as such. I just looked at the fact of it. Here you had 50 albums by Louis Armstrong, 100 albums by Duke, and 3 albums by Tatum. It was the incongruity of it was impossible. So I thought someone had to do it, and so I did it.
Norman Granz, and this is Cherokee with Art Tatum, recorded on April 22nd, 1954, in Los Angeles. The same session resulted in 26 other gems. Thanks to Norman Granz, the art of Tatum continues to amaze, surprise, and delight. In 1956, Norman Granz formed Verve Records, which he would eventually sell to MGM in 1960. At MGM's insistence, a clause was inserted into the sales contract, forbidding Norman from owning or operating another record label for 7 years. Disc jockey Les Davis describes how Norman occupied himself during that period and beyond.
Between 60 and 74, Norman Granz did no recording. He continued to present jazz at the Philharmonic tours in Europe. He stopped the U.S. tours in 57, and then promoted concerts by artists like, are you ready? The Osmonds, the Mothers of Invention, Santana. I mean, people he admitted that he had no musical interest in. But after all, he was a promoter, and he knew their marquee value, and so Norman Granz put up the money and made money.
Norman Granz proved himself to be a remarkably resourceful man. In 1974, he started his last label, Pablo Records. His longtime friend and associate, the late Benny Green, wrote liner notes for the majority of the Pablo releases, and in doing so, raised the standard of such notes to uncommon heights. Benny Green describes his friend away from music.
Norman actually has a tremendous diversification of interests. He knows as much about modern painting as he does about jazz. He's a great collector. He has an obsessional interest in literature, and although he has trouble with his eyes now, he's read more or less everything there is to read. Norman has a real student's interest in cooking and food. Norman Granz is the kind of man, I believe, that would have been outstanding whatever he'd chosen to do. There are a few people like that. If it had gone into the stock exchange or politics, whatever it was, he'd have been the one of his generation, the same as he was in jazz. He's just one of those guys.
I happen to like the jam session because I'm a great believer in the role of the individual in any art. And I don't think it's difficult to argue that each day we have more and more conformity in our lives and less opportunity for the individual, whether it be in the state politically, whether it be in business economically, and the same with music, you see. And I really feel that jazz as I know it will vanish, because where is the young player going to get an apprenticeship? And it's not looking backwards or being nostalgic. It's a question of standards. I'm a great believer in the individual, as I say, and I think we're in such an era of conformity that I don't know how the environment in the future can nurture the individual.
Nurturing the individual. That's exactly what Norman Granz has done throughout his career. Be it Lester Young or Stan Getz, Roy Eldridge or Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie or Lionel Hampton, name them, and chances are Norman Granz has recorded or presented them in concert. After selling Pablo Records late in 1986, Norman Granz chose to retire. For someone who has never played or sung so much as a single note, his position in the Jazz Hall of Fame is assured. As a result of his efforts, the music of the jazz greats will continue to be heard and admired, influencing those who come to the fore in this new millennium. As Norman has said, it's a question of standards. And in terms of concert presentation and record production, Norman Granz set and maintained the highest of standards.
Here we go. You want to talk over first?
No, you want to do what we were doing?
Yeah.
We're just friends.
You want to do Just Friends?
All right.
Do Just Friends, I don't care.
That's a good title for the album.
All right.
I'm working for a new album here.
All right, here we go. Ready? Here we go. 2000 560, take one, Just Friends, the All Stars.
Our tribute to Norman Granz was written by Elliot Meadow and produced by Nick Lowe at Demas Productions in Scotland, with additional production by Douglas Campbell and Susan Linstead. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens, assistant producer Madeline Smith, our editor Molly Murphy, administrative assistant Linda Browen, website coordinator John Murph. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Or check us out at nprjazz.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, arts, and culture. Additional support has been provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to a celebration of the life and career of record producer and concert promoter Norman Granz. He died in 2001 at the age of 83. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music, including our new series, Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.